Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Carol Boyce-Davies. Boyce-Davies is a professor of Africana Studies and English at Cornell University. She is the author of many important books, including Left of Karl Marx, The Political Life of Black Communist Claudia Jones, and Black Women, Writing and Identity, Migrations of the Subject. Her most recent and the focus of our discussion is titled Caribbean Spaces, Escapes from Twilight Zones. This book draws on personal experience and cultural theory and gives us new insight into Caribbean cultures. Caribbean Spaces was published by the University of Illinois Press in November 2013. I'm speaking to Carol Boyce-Davies by phone from Florida. Carol Boyce-Davies, thank you so much for joining us. Now, you have a really interesting biography. You were born in Trinidad, you lived and studied in Nigeria, and then you landed in upstate New York. And your book sort of follows this trajectory. And is that where Escapes from Twilight Zones came from?
In part, both. You talked about landing in upstate New York, and Twilight Zones, part of it absolutely comes from Rod Serling. And why? Because I taught at Binghamton for about 15 years, and my daughters and I always had a standing joke whenever we went out of town that we were coming back to the Twilight Zone. So I began to sort of extend the logic all the way to thinking not just about upstate New York, but thinking about places that bring together different realities.
You describe unreal places with big consequences.
Exactly.
So talk to us. Tell us more about this.
Well, you know, the thing is, one of the things, and I mentioned this in one of the chapters in the book, that would impact my daughters and I as we drove around upstate New York, was that we would bypass a series of signs which would talk about Native peoples as if they were gone.
Mm.
And, for example, crossing over from Owego, from Binghamton to Owego, there's a sign right at the bridge that says this was a Wagia, an Indian village burned to the ground by General X on his way to meet General X. So they were always fascinated by that. So basically, that is one of the things I'm talking about, that upstate New York is a place of sort of paradoxical freedom, but also destruction of certain people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
So you have, on the one hand, African Americans finding a certain kind of refuge upstate, but always that sort of possibility of danger. So this is what I was trying to get at with that Twilight Zone logic.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that Rod Serling had hit on that and had come from Binghamton really helped me with that. And as I thought about it further, I began to, after I published the book, I went online and looked at Twilight Zone, and I was like, really quite stunned by the fact that he was actually talking precisely about that, about zones of instability where different realities touch, where one can walk out of one existence into another one. And I think that's what I wanted to get at in that titling.
And of course, because you are from Trinidad in the Caribbean, you start out in that landscape. And so you've had to take on many, many different landscapes and cultures. Talk to us about the fact that your family migrated to the U.S. in the mid-1960s. What a time of tumult in this country and change.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's fascinating looking back, but I came to the U.S. as an undergrad student in 1967, and it was in my freshman year that Martin Luther King died. So following that, one was ushered in rapidly to what was then called the Black Power period, with people like Stokely Carmichael and others as prime actors. So my sense of being a black woman in the U.S., a black person in the U.S., comes with that sort of activist framing. And I think that's probably one of the most enhancing, I suppose, aspects of my life, to really have had a part in seeing that period and what it produced in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, now, of course, we see the ways in which a lot of those gains being lost somehow.
And trampled upon, yeah.
With the last Supreme Court rulings and so on.
You know, I want you to talk about the fact that you are from a different country. And so what was that feeling like as you, a black woman coming from Trinidad to upstate New York? I mean, what kind of a person was looking through your eyes at the U.S. culture at that time? What was your consciousness as somebody from Trinidad? You probably weren't politicized as much as you became during the 60s in the U.S. Is that true?
Absolutely not.
When
I come of age in the Caribbean at a point in time when we are moving from colonialism to an independent status. So I'm in Trinidad as a young girl at that changeover from that colonial rule to an independent Trinidad and Tobago. Mm. And it really helped that I had a prime minister who is the author of Capitalism and Slavery at that time, Eric Williams, who would have nightly lectures on the radio back then, which I kind of listened to as background music in a way, or background noise. But my parents listened to them, and the whole communities listened to his discussions about capitalism and slavery and imperialism and that sort of thing. So one had already a kind of preparation, if you will, for being an enhanced, independent thinking person. We saw, in other words, the royal family say goodbye and an independent Caribbean nation, which it was supposed to be, come alive. And in many ways, this is the kind of thing I'm trying to recapture in Caribbean spaces, because I'm trying to look at the logic, which I learned from many people who were activists at that time, the logic of a Caribbean nation, not so many separate island nation states, each one sort of vying for an independent reality, which they can never really attain. So I'm trying to get back to that, and the logic of that had to do with seeing the possibilities of connection, seeing what some people refer to as the in-between spaces as really full and palpable, as the Caribbean poet Derek Walcott puts it in his poem, The Sea is History.
Now, you also talk about your first trip to Africa, and it was to Nigeria, and you say you felt no romance about going to Africa. Talk to us a little bit about that, because that's part of this twilight zone in your book.
I know, and I'm trying to, looking back, wondering how come I did not feel that. First of all, I had received an amazing scholarship to do my PhD at the University of Ibadan in African Literature from the Trinidad and Tobago government. So I was going as a, you know, really endowed scholarly person. I wasn't sort of making a trip then just for 2 weeks or what have you. So I felt totally empowered, and I had done a master's at Howard University where I studied with some of the major, you know, leading scholars of African literatures and cultures and so on. People like C.L.R. James walked around my campus on a normal basis. One could sit in a class with him and so on. So essentially, I had that kind of prep. So going to Africa was not sort of just making the romantic touchdown journey, but more about learning what I could from that experience. And it was bittersweet because in some ways, you know, you get ushered in directly into a post-colonial African context where people are struggling for economic realities that I guess now one sees the downside or the negative side of some of that in, for example, the Boko Haram capturing of those girls and so on. So basically you're dealing with cultures that were colonized again, that were now trying to make themselves into something. And I walk directly into that. So I'm feeling, I suppose, because of the preparation I had before, a sort of sense of exploration, but an exploration that is not romanticized. It's not the Gavi return to a romantic Africa.
You know, I thought that was really refreshing that you were able to admit that, though, because there is a romantic vision, whether it's real or, you know, hoped for, when African-American people talk about going to Africa. So I thought it was interesting that you were sort of ambivalent about it.
Yeah, I'm really pleased that I was looking back. In fact, I was reading a young scholar's work, The Predicament of Blackness, and she did her research in Ghana, and she actually commented on the fact that we forget that those countries similarly were colonized and therefore had all of the scars of colonialism, racial markings, which she saw in the whole question of skin bleaching, and a whole host of other ways in which racism similarly touched African places. So it's not that they were immune somehow or they were the repository of some sort of untouched blackness, but that they actually were also struggling with how to make themselves anew after all those other formations that affected what would have become Africa if it did not have that encounter.
Yeah. Did you feel like when you went to Africa that you were going as a Caribbean person or as an Americanized person? Could you tell? Did people treat you like you were an American, or was that a different experience?
That's actually one of the first times somebody has asked me that question, and I'm so happy you did. When I showed up to my advisor's office, and he was somebody who was an expert in African literature that I was going to work with. I had come from Howard with a master's in African studies with an emphasis on in literature and sociology. And I show up at his office and I told him this is what I wanted to do. And he said, oh, you Americans are always in a hurry. And I said, I'm from the Caribbean. He said, it's all the same thing.
So,
really, can you imagine? So I guess it was this logic of the Americas as people who are diasporized and are coming with different sense of entitlement. And of course, being a young woman at that time, I had to sort of navigate what that meant in terms of, you know, sexism for sure. So essentially, I think it was a combination, and I still carry that combination. In fact, many of the ways in which the book is framed is precisely to get at that combination. I find often there are too many minor tensions between Caribbeans and African Americans, for example, and I try in one of the chapters to really dismantle that and terms of how we think.
Yeah, you bring the two bridges together in many ways, and you do it with your life.
Yeah, I try to. I live that life.
Yeah.
You live right in the hyphen, I suppose. You know what I mean?
Well, I understand why you call it a twilight zone.
You got it.
You know what you say also in the book? You say to understand Caribbean space, one has to understand the peculiar context of domination existing around U.S. power. And so talk to us more about that. I mean, obviously, U.S.
Right.
power is supposedly on the decline, but not really.
Well, yeah. And, you know, I was teaching at Binghamton at a time when Emmanuel Wallerstein was one of the leading scholars there. And he had developed something he called the world system. And one of his arguments was precisely that at the waning aspect of a power is when it's probably most dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And one sees that also similarly in terms of how one is treated, black women, for example, the woman who was thrown up on the hood of the car in Arizona and so on, you know, and others are treated, and of course in the larger system, right?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you have this sort of white male power, which clearly is waning, but on the one hand, still has that ability to inflict that kind of pain. So I believe that's like a microcosm of what we mean, in the sense that the Caribbean is still within the U.S. orbit. And if you look at the pathway of a Cuba, for example, still suffering from embargoes, still suffering from an attempt to create a different pathway. And then you have other relations in the Caribbean, which are still colonized. So when you look at the Francophone Caribbean, Martinique, Guadeloupe, and so on, they're still operating as departments of France. We're in a very colonial kind of relationship. So the way that the U.S. interacts with those former colonial powers is always leveraged by that past and also the kind of present way in which the U.S. still has that military control and dominance that it can inflict whenever it needs to. So as a Caribbean subject, one is used to understanding that negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
For many of us, the U.S. functions still as a kind of colonial power in a sense, and this explains the migration issue in many different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have companies who are operating with economic control in those regions and assuming open markets and so on, you will have people similarly migrating towards what is seen as or marketed as an ideal space, right? And the same thing happened with Caribbeans moving to Europe from the 1940s onward. That would create that Caribbean diaspora in England and France and other places in Europe to a certain degree. So it's that complex navigation where you have love, hate, desire being repelled all at the same time, I think, which captures that relationship of Caribbean space, I think,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah. You know what I've always wanted to ask somebody from the Caribbean, too, is it's thought of in the U.S. as kind of a tourist culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so talk to us about how that informs the population. The ugly American comes up in my head when I think about Americans going to the Caribbean, thinking it's kind of just a playground.
Right. There's a wonderful film which some of us use in teaching called Life and Death, which captures it wonderfully. And it actually uses the words of Jamaica Kincaid at the start to talk about how people sometimes reach to a Caribbean location, often very Sandals-like or Club Med-like,
mm-hmm,
and assume
mm-hmm.
that is the reality. And in fact, one of my nephews recently, who is Caribbean-American too, but born in the U.S., of course, got married in one of the Sandals, and I finally was able to go into a Sandals in Jamaica to see what it's like. So basically, it's a completely isolated location, separated from the local community, in which once you get in there, everything is available, from bakeries and ice creams and all sorts of things. And then they also use up a lot of water because you know, there are pools and people shower as long as they want to, and spas and all sorts of things. So compare that with local people's inability to have structure. The roads are fixed up then to those locations, but not necessarily in other parts of the island. So the politicians somehow are part of a structure of maintaining that, because they see this as an easy path to development, but really it's a certain kind of development. So according to Kinky, the tourist is innocent, really, because this person comes in wanting to sort of live a different life, but at the same time is implicated in a larger system, which he or she did not create, but is participating in unwittingly. So it's a complicated, it's both, right? It's one wanting a design. We are all tourists in a certain kind of way, not so, because we go to different locations. But to me, it's how one interacts with that space and the knowledge one has of that particular location. And one hopes that because the Caribbean is so close, that we move before, beyond the sort of come back to Jamaica logic, to understanding that these are places which are also struggling.
Yeah.
And then there's a whole other piece we didn't even talk about, which is called sex tourism or romance tourism, where women and men are used for, you know, sexual purposes, and that's a whole other debate, though.
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. Now, you talk about how Caribbean women leave their homes often, and they come to the U.S., and the U.S. proclaims equality, but that's not really the case for women, especially black women. So talk to us about that. I mean, women of color are often heads of households. They end up getting domestic work, abusive people hiring them. Talk to us about it.
Yeah, I have a chapter in the book which talks about that and actually gives a few stories from people I know, family, friends of family, and so on. Many of us have relatives who were in that kind of employment. And the point is that the income that they gain is way more than they would have received back in the Caribbean. So, again, that's the draw, the pull. The point is often, for many of the women who worked domestic labor jobs in cities like New York and so on, they often did not get registered to receive Social Security and other kinds of benefits. So often they worked and they thought it was better, but then when they, at the end of their service, they realized they did not have that much. Now, some people were fortunate in that they were able to find employers who were really thoughtful and who made sure that they got, you know, paid well or given benefits.
Yeah, the entitlements were.
Exactly. So it depends, right, on the kind of person you end up working with. But if you're working with somebody who has no clue again or who is exploitative, you can spend many hours, as happened in the U.S. South to African Americans as well, working long hours to the disadvantage of your own family. And this happened to many Caribbeans as well, because remember, many of them left children at home, came to work in the U.S. and would send back as much as they could, but they ended up being separated from their children for those periods.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people do think the U.S. has more equality than it does, and that it isn't as sexist as it is, right? I mean, and that's part of what the experience is for people who come here believing the propaganda.
Right, of course. And it's the pull of a different economic reality. Many women I know, from friends of mine whose parents came up and worked in that way, were able to save a lot of money and send back resources back to the Caribbean to help other people. In my case, my mother came up as well, but she was already an adult, had a career already as a school teacher. So in her case, it was more like accompanying my ability to go to university and providing whatever help she could at that time. So for many of those women, the logic of working hard in the U.S. had to do with preparing another generation. So many of us are beneficiaries of that kind of work and have to consistently acknowledge that. And I consistently also acknowledge the fact that African Americans fought for many of the rights that people from the Caribbean now assume as their given rights. But these were fought for, as you know, the Civil Rights Act was commemorated yesterday. So none of that would have happened.
Yeah, exactly. And we're still working on making that a perfect philosophy, right? We've got a long way to go. Now, you talk about this, that people migrating to other places to start new and better lives, and yet they often hold tight to their original cultural identities and form, you know, almost little cities unto themselves. Talk to us about that. A lot of people actually seem not to want to assimilate in some ways.
You know, it's funny to think of that, but what I was seeing from my own travels was that we had different sectors where people sort of established communities. So whether you're talking Brooklyn or certain areas in Miami, Little Haiti, mm-hmm. and Little Havana, and so on. And I think it's comforting to be in a community that is recognizable, where one can find foodstuffs and get one's hair done and run into people that you may have seen before and so on. So essentially, I think that is the logic of those communities, but you end up, yes, with enclave-like communities in the U.S. But I don't think that's unusual, because one finds Irish communities, Italian. So I think human beings are really strange characters in a sense. On the one hand, they move towards a certain kind of integration, but on the other, they feel comfort in their own community structures. So I don't think it should be, this is where the question of equality comes in, right? It doesn't have to be a situation where one is disadvantaged then because one chooses to be in a certain community, but that one has an open ability to be wherever. I think that would be, and not be, you know, treated unfairly and so on.
And to be with people who are familiar. How did you navigate that? I mean, you seem to be part of the broader culture in upstate New York, obviously, a university community as well. Did you have to make a conscious decision not to stay in a small community where you were more comfortable?
But yeah, in my case, I suppose it's linked to the kind of academic life and work I've had. So I have to really at least acknowledge that and to talk about that in terms of the opportunity and a certain kind of privilege, too. You know, we forget sometimes that having that ability to work out of an academic context gives us that bit more privilege. In spite of the fact that this young lady, and I keep saying this young lady, Ursula Orr, who got slammed like that, you know, I was teaching a class last semester on Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, and it was called Reading the New Jim Crow, but we read many other things. And one of the things that students and faculty keep as an illusion is that they're pretty safe on campus. What the situation showed us was that, you know, as a black person in community, one is never really fully safe, and it's a scary kind of reality check. So in my case, yes, the privilege and the ability to work in an institution of higher learning and to be able to teach and to have the ability to write and publish is part of what I take for granted now, but it comes with a lot of hard work and preparation. We have to really always say that. It's not sort of automatically that you're recognized. But along with that, it meant for me as well being able to navigate many different communities, and I think I've been able to feel comfortable doing that in my own way.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Carol Boyce Davies. We're talking about her book, Caribbean Spaces, Escapes from Twilight Zones. Now you talk about Haiti as a symbol of the unrelenting humanity of African people and how they learn to survive in the harshest conditions. Talk to us more about that, especially that 2010 earthquake showed us some of this humanity.
I know. I tried to frame Haiti as having a series of kind of halos. And it came from a silly place in a way, because I listened to Beyonce singing Haiti, I Can See Your Halo. And I'm like, okay, I don't think she has a clue about what she's saying there. But essentially what I saw Haiti as is kind of an extreme representation of the black condition. But not just the black condition, the human condition. And it's part of this whole idea that we live with an illusion of safety, but you can have something really horrible happen, whether it's, you know, a flood that washes away your home, as you sometimes see in the Midwest U.S., or a horrible earthquake, or anything else, the tsunamis and so on. And because of that, one has to really live a humble life. But it also shows you how one also recreates and remakes oneself in difficult situations. So for me, Haiti and that earthquake came across in that way. But as it relates specifically to the black condition, it had to do with the fact that Haiti was the first place where Africans in the diaspora claimed a space outside of oppression. And because of that, for many scholars, it had to consistently struggle back into being considered on par with other nations. In fact, Haiti had to pay reparations to France up until recently for daring to have an independent state. Mm-hmm. So essentially, Haiti in a way represents what I call that constant, what a deferral of the full achievement of what liberation should have been, but also that desire to consistently remake oneself. And I was fortunate to go to Haiti before the earthquake. I haven't seen it since. And I was always struck by what one sees there. You see, on the one hand, extreme poverty, but you also see a culture that was actually trying to make itself into something really powerful at one point. You can see it in the architecture, some of its monuments, its statues, and so on. And that, to me, is what I see as the contradiction that Haiti presents in many ways the black experience also captures. So if one were to transfer that to thinking about African-American peoples in the U.S., one gets a lesser version of that, in which you have a series of advances, and then you have within the state itself, as we were talking about the Civil Rights Act, within the state itself and its Supreme Court attempts to sort of pull that back. So you have the constant pull of achievement, you know, the Martin Luther Kings and so on, and then on the other hand, you have a possible Clarence Thomas. You know, you have the ability then of somebody to smile through making such horrendous decisions, which can have negative effects on people's lives.
Exactly. And he's not a possible Clarence Thomas. He is a Clarence Thomas.
I know.
Let's talk about racism. You use the word reading racism, and what you mean, according to the book, is hidden and explicit codings, various languages and behaviors. Talk to us about racism in your experience as somebody who navigates all of these fault lines, as you call them.
Right. But that's a wonderful term that I got from C.L.R. James, and he was actually talking about the fact that there's some natural fault lines within societies. In the Caribbean case, as he saw through Haiti, on the one hand, you have the sort of, you know, the lofty rhetoric of freedom and liberty and so on that you get from the slave masters as they describe their realities, but then the conditions of the people, that automatically creates a fault line. Okay, racism, what I was trying to do in my discussion of racism was to try to at least move beyond sort of the prejudicial manifestations that one gets with bad name calling and so on, to really have particularly Caribbean readers understand some of the codings of racism, which they sometimes miss completely, and that see that racism is not simply just those prejudicial behaviors, but actually a series of structural systems which then impact on one's life in many different ways, from the economic, you know, the way police handles one, the judiciary, housing patterns, you know, leisure, entertainment, everything. So that for me, the question of how to read racism is a way of understanding those structural inequities and not just reading whether or not one has a separate entrance, as was the more obvious manifestation in Jim Crow racism. Mm-hmm. And the point I'm making is that for Caribbean peoples, because they did not have those official markers of Jim Crow racism that one saw in the South, you know, colored entrances and water fountains and, you know, locations and so on, they've missed the fact that the Caribbean also has visions of racism, that there were country clubs that one could not attend, that unless you were working there, that there are hotels too that people still can't enter unless they're really part of the clientele or they're working there. So you have a series of relationships whereby one has, you know, a kind of obvious racial structuring going on, but people are not able to read it because they're looking for the superficial coded Jim Crow-like racism.
Carol, we're almost out of time. I'm really sorry we can't continue this discussion. Do you have any contact information you can give people in case they want to get in touch?
My Cornell email is ceb278@cornell.edu. That's the easiest one. If not, they can go on the Cornell website, Africana Studies, and actually there you would find my biography, short biography, and some contact information. And the book is Caribbean Spaces, Escape from Twilight Zones, and it's available from the University of Illinois Press. It's on Amazon, and it's in all those other places that one finds books.
Yes.
I believe it's in Buffalo Books, and it was there at one point as well.
Yes. Well, Carol Boyce-Davies, thank you so much for joining us. And again, good luck with all the great work that you do. I hope people will read this book. It's very important. Carol Boyce-Davies, thank you so much.
Such a joy always talking with you, Tish. Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.